The job of a CEO is to have a very strong conviction about an idea and to sell that idea to everyone. You have to focus on one problem, get your solution out there, demonstrate that the technology that you have truly is transformative and can do the thing that you can do. And if you can complete that arc, you can unlock all the other stuff. It's not about the money. It's about whether or not you think you can withstand the risk. That's all based off of, have you identified a real problem? If you've identified a real problem, all of the hardship is worth it because you can have that North Star. There's a real problem that somebody really, really wants you to solve for them. Let's go do that.
Today on Rethink Change, I'm speaking with Dr. Westbrook Weaver, the CEO of Tempo Therapeutics. Westbrook has led Tempo through major inflection points, from pioneering their synthetic MAP scaffolding technology to preparing for clinical trials. Tempo is redefining tissue regeneration with injectable biomaterials that help the body heal instead of scar. Westbrook, I'm looking forward to having you explain what all that means, because I had no idea. Welcome to Rethink Change.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me. It's a real exciting opportunity to be able to chat with y'all today.
Awesome. So for starters, why don't you just tell us a little bit about Tempo?
Tempo is, in a sense, one of my babies. Tempo was something that came out of work that I was doing in academia. So I was getting my PhD in biomedical engineering at UCLA, and I did that work for my PhD, and then was kind of continuing work as a postdoctoral researcher at UCLA, working with some collaborators in the biomedical engineering department, chemical engineering, and the departments of medicine. And we basically kind of stumbled across an invention of a new way to think about making a biomaterial. I can talk about what that is. And ultimately, that technology that we developed and the intellectual property developed there, we spun out into a startup company that we called Tempo Therapeutics. I was one of the co-founders, became the CEO. That was 9 years ago. Have been building that ever since. So Tempo still is a fairly small company. We're under 10 employees, you know, very virtualized company focused on technology innovation and product development. But ultimately, we kind of had to focus on what we were going to do with the technology that we had created, right? I think one of the things that has been most challenging, and I'm sure a lot of probably biotech or med tech founders have this challenge, is, especially when you're an engineer or a scientist starting a company, is you think a lot about the technology and you're like, okay, I've created this thing. What am I going to use it for? I've got this hammer. What nail am I going to hit? And a big challenge for us was going through that process of determining what is the right thing to do with the technology that we have, which is actually, I don't know, in my opinion, a much harder way to go about the process that all companies should do, which is, what's the problem that I'm solving and can I find a thing to solve that problem? So it's sort of like we went in the opposite direction from the way that, if I could do it over again, I would do it the opposite way. I would really focus on what's a real problem in the world, define what that problem is, understand how that affects people, right? How they view that problem, and then just go be technology agnostic as to the solution to that problem. I think a lot of times, and this is true for us, you spend a lot of time and effort trying to solve a problem married to a technology. We've been lucky in being able to find a problem that actually our technology is well suited to solve, and have really focused in on that problem, which I can, you know, talk about moving forward. But I think that that's something that was a big challenge for us in the early days, is going that kind of opposite direction in that process of, I've got a tech, what's the problem, rather than focusing on a problem, making sure it's real, and then not worrying about where you get the solution from as long as it's the solution for the problem.
So how would you simplify what Tempo does? Or do you have an analogy of what it does?
So when I talk about what Tempo does now, I don't even talk about the technology. I say, and what Tempo does is, we are making skin cancer survivors' lives better. That's what we're doing, right? People who have skin cancer, whether it's melanoma or non-melanoma skin cancer, they can get that skin cancer surgically removed. And especially with non-melanoma skin cancer, that's a very effective procedure, right? Effective 99.9% of the time. But they have a lot of challenges living their lives after that surgical procedure, especially because non-melanoma is a recurrent condition. People are going to get that over and over and over again. And so what Tempo does is that we focus on making those people's lives livable. We let them get back to their lives as quickly as possible after those skin cancer surgeries, knowing that, you know, some of these patients are going to have it over and over and over again. And you don't want to live your life just going in and out of surgery, you know? So that's what we're trying to do at Tempo, is make the lives of skin cancer survivors better, back to normal faster, and being able to feel good about yourself after you have to get that skin cancer removed.
Well, Ward can relate. He is a member of that group.
Exactly. I mean, it's a growing problem. I mean, 5.5 million people in the United States every year are diagnosed with a basal cell or squamous cell carcinoma, which is a non-melanoma skin cancer. About 2.7 million of those people get a surgical procedure to remove that non-melanoma skin cancer. And about 1 million of those people have a very long and challenging recovery process after that surgical procedure that can last 6 to 9 months. And usually the best case scenario is you have a pretty big scar or a big divot in your face or your head, because it's sun exposure is what leads you to get these non-melanoma skin cancers. So it's in typically areas that are, you know, what you might call cosmetically sensitive. But, you know, the way I look at it is, when a non-melanoma skin cancer survivor looks at themselves in the mirror, we want them to see themselves. Right? Not somebody that's got a bunch of pockmarks on their face and they're like, oh, I'm just always focused on these things that are so negative about myself. That's what we want to, that's the problem that we want to solve.
So you no longer have those divots in your head, those deep divots.
Exactly. So what we do, and we can talk a little bit about our solution, right? So this is kind of where the tech and the solution comes in. So we create and manufacture and sell a fully synthetic biomaterial that comes in a little squirt syringe that a dermatologic surgeon, who's the person that's doing the skin cancer surgery for you, after they remove that skin cancer and there's basically a big kind of hole in your head or your face, they fill up that hole with our material. And it's a flowable material. It kind of looks like hair gel, basically. It fills up the volume of that area where the skin cancer was, and it actually becomes a part of the patient. So it integrates with the patient's own tissue. The patient's own cells grow into that three-dimensional matrix that our product creates. And what it does is it completely eliminates something called dermal atrophy, which is the divot that's formed in the skin afterwards. And it significantly reduces hyper and hypopigmentation, which is kind of the discoloration of a scar that forms afterwards. So we're basically able to restore the contour of the face or the head, and we're able to restore the skin coloration of the face or the head. So that allows that person to not have this thing on their face or their head. And it's a single procedure. It's done one time at the time of surgery. Again, it allows that patient to get to recovery faster, and it allows them to recover to a place where they can recognize themselves again.
Can you see yourself going to market where your company salespeople will go to the dermatologist, or would it go through a drug company or a device company that would become your rep? So they would be OEMs.
In the early days, we're actually going to be doing the sales and the marketing of our own products. So in the dermatologic space, in the Mohs surgery space, so Mohs is the name of the procedure that's done. Mohs surgeons today don't have any products that were developed for them by them. They are currently being sold or attempted to be sold products by reps that come into their office that was developed for another patient, not developed for their patient, not developed by them with any of their input. And what we want to do is we want to develop something for Mohs surgeons, with Mohs surgeons, and involve them in every step of the way. And that allows us to then actually undergo an early commercialization effort with very little sales and marketing force needed. Now, eventually, you know, our goal is to scale that either through a commercial partner, like a branded commercial partner, or an OEM or kind of contract sales force. But it's all based off of early success in a very small targeted release. The way I see it is we need to show that our sales cycle works, right? You need to reduce that sales cycle to practice. You need to show reorders. You need to show that your customers want your product over and over and over again.
You want to be able to have your salesperson sell one thing, not come in and say, here's my 150 items. What do you need? This is like, this is all I do because I know this is what you need.
I agree. And that's really where contract sales forces can be very challenging, because, you know, those sales reps are motivated to do what's right for them, right? Which is, I'm going to sell the thing that gets sold the most. And again, the strategy that we're taking, which is very different than any of the companies that are currently trying to sell to Mohs surgeons, is we want to be evidence-based. Clinical trial data, randomized controlled clinical trials. There is so much out there in the post-surgical healing space that, you know, sales reps are going to try and sell stuff based off of a case study or a couple of case series. It's like, if I'm a surgeon, how am I supposed to know what the right thing is for my patient if you can't show me real clinical science? It's asinine, honestly. Because how could it possibly be the best thing for the patient if the surgeon doesn't have the information to make an educated decision about what product they should use?
So what's your communication strategy going to be to the early adopters of these doctors? Because again, you're in this unique spot where even though the patients are the end users of the product, the doctors are really your target audience.
100%. Yeah, I guess technically the patient is the end user because the product is being applied to them and they are agreeing to use it because they have a set of choices. And I don't want to misrepresent or say anything that's not true here. I'm saying my opinion, my viewpoint. The surgeon, the doctor, is the customer.
Absolutely, because the patient looks to the doctor who's told them you've got the problem, who's going to fix the problem, and they're going to say whatever it takes to fix the problem.
Exactly. You know, when I'm just trying to envision, when I think about it, I envision myself as being the patient, right? I go into my doctor. I have a skin cancer. My doctor is going to treat that skin cancer. I'm going to say, doc, you do what you think is the right thing to do, because I personally trust our medical education system to train doctors to be able to do the best thing for patients. So therefore, my customer is the doctor, and I need to convince the doctor why this is the right thing for their patient, because then if they believe that that's the right thing for their patient, they're going to use it for that patient.
Say, for example, everything's going to be approved. You'll be on the market in 3 years. I don't know how long it's going to be. And then you sit back and go, okay, what am I going to do next? Where can I use this technology next? What are you thinking?
Other areas that we are looking at and actually doing some early development in for our technology are in the craniofacial reconstructive surgery arena and what's called ear, nose, and throat. So basically what we're looking at in general is an injectable version of our product that goes through a needle that can fill space inside the body. So rather than being applied topically to restore volume after skin cancer, it's a similar concept, but we're kind of creating volume inside the body. And we're using it for really three key areas. One is airway restoration, so volume airway restoration that can be either related to congenital defects like cleft palate, cleft lip, or retropharyngeal insufficiency, which is a very long word for, you know, saying that your airway is malformed. And basically injecting our material to kind of fill up different spaces to basically structure the airway as it was meant to be structured. And again, what is unique about our product is that it's a synthetic product and it goes into the volume that you want to inject it, and it kind of fills up the space, but it's actually replaced with the patient's own tissue, right? So you can create permanent volume inside people, but the material doesn't have to be there forever, right? So being able to restore airway volume and congenital defects, or actually in aging patients that have something called glottic insufficiency, where your vocal folds just kind of get smaller and smaller over time, and then you start to aspirate and you have a really high risk of pneumonia. So that's kind of one area that we're developing in. We're developing in another area, which is actually urologic. Again, a similar concept where you're basically looking at patients that have stress urinary incontinence, being able to fill the wall of the ureter to be able to make it a little bit thicker so that those patients can actually alleviate the symptoms of stress urinary incontinence. Again, what we're doing is we're filling that space with the material. That material is replaced by tissue and kind of creates permanent volume. And we're also looking at some aesthetic areas. So being able to treat, you know, maybe either facial lipoatrophy or for purely aesthetic reasons, being able to fill up and kind of sculpt different areas of the face. And then a final area that's something that's kind of far off, but we're very interested in is actually what we call structural heart, which is jargon for literally actually physically treating the heart. So cardiovascular is a general area, but we're focusing specifically on treating the heart for patients that have heart failure, where what happens is the wall of your ventricle, which is a part of your heart, actually thins out because you've maybe had a couple of heart attacks over time, small heart attacks. Once people get into heart failure, that ventricular wall, the muscle, is so thin that basically your heart starts to like balloon out. That's what leads you into heart failure. And our concept is that by introducing our material as a filler, basically into that wall, you can bulk it back up and you can actually restore some function in the heart. So again, that's way off in the future, but these are kind of the areas that we're looking at. Very generally, the way that I see our business is initially, we're looking at topical application of our product for a dermatologic purpose. Then we're taking that technology and trying to take it deep in the body and see if we can actually restore some function of critical organs and tissues by filling it up as well. And so that's kind of the thought process.
Pretty amazing.
But again, the way I look at this is everything has to be hinged on the first success. You know, as an engineer and a scientist, I was always focused on the platform initially. And it's like, oh, we can do all these things. We're going to go boil the ocean. Let's do it. You know, that sounds neat, but you just can't do it. You just can't do it. You have to focus on one thing, one problem, get your solution out there, demonstrate that the technology that you have truly is transformative and can do the thing that you can do. And if you can complete that arc, you can unlock all the other stuff. But if you get too sidetracked with all the other things, you're never going to complete the first arc. And then you're just going to be sitting in this, you know, kind of nowhere land forever. And I think that's where we started off, frankly. And then once we got focused and we really got dialed in to skin cancer, now we have a clear path for how to complete that first arc.
So this is really transformative technology, or it seems like breakthrough, but there has to be other companies that are making at least a perceived similar type of a product. How do you communicate your value or differentiation when you're talking to investors, when you're talking to potential, you know, organizations?
So it has to be very focused on the specific indication and the specific patient. You can't, you know, again, when you're trying to do the boil the ocean approach, you have too many different competitors that are in different areas, and you can't explain all of those things at once, and it gets too confusing. That's just, honestly, that's another reason why you have to be focused, because you have to focus on here's where I'm going, here's what my patient is, and here's what that patient currently has an option for today, which is a competitor for us, and then here's the other things that are being developed for that patient. That is a story that you can tell. To walk through that story with the skin cancer patient, the options that they have today are a complex surgical reconstruction procedure or the use of something called a bioengineered skin substitute, which is basically a tissue taken from another person or an animal and dehydrated and packaged into a package. And it basically comes as a sheet. And those things can be applied to the open surgical site with the idea that they can kind of help with the healing process. So those are our competitors today. Bioengineered skin substitutes, because they're delivered as sheets and they have natural sources of material, are not very well adopted in the dermatologic surgery end of things. They're used very commonly in chronic wound treatments, so like diabetic foot ulcers, foot wounds, and things like that, chronic wounds. But they're really not adopted very well in the derm end of things. They're used in less than 2% of cases. The reason being that they don't restore skin contour because they're thin sheets. They're not volumetric. The sourcing of the material, honestly, a lot of people don't want to utilize, whether it comes from a pig or if it comes from amniotic tissue. It's not something that people really want to use that much. So the patient isn't really interested in using it. Now, remember, this comes back to understanding what's the value proposition to the patient, right? The patient is presented with an option. Let's imagine you're a diabetic foot ulcer patient. And you have this chronic wound that you've had for 2 years. Your options are get this wound healed or get a below the knee amputation, right? 50% of the time. That's a different calculus than if you're a skin cancer patient and you get your skin cancer removed and you say to yourself, do I want to have a scar that I'm really not going to like, or can I heal and have no scar and have a much better outcome and a better quality of life? Those are two different calculus equations. Understanding that calculus and understanding how you provide a patient with a product that's going to deliver the value that they want at the price point that is the right price point, right? So again, these bioengineered skin substitutes are extremely costly. They range from anywhere from $3,500 to $30,000. And the entire cost that Medicare currently pays to treat a skin cancer surgery patient, or a non-melanoma skin cancer surgery patient, is about $3,500. So again, the calculus there isn't working. And we have a unique aspect of our product because it's fully synthetic, easy to manufacture, that we can make it at a price point that makes sense, right, for the insurer to pay. And then we can still have a great, you know, business opportunity there. So that's the competitive advantage that we have that none of these other naturally sourced materials have. And also just simply the volumetric nature of our product allows us to rebuild that tissue volume and restore the skin contour.
Pivoting away from the science and the technology itself and into some of the lessons learned that you've come across along the way, can you think of any anecdotal stories or just times to where you had imposter syndrome of, oh my God, I'm in over my head, that can just provide good insight into the trials and tribulations of just being a CEO in an emerging company?
I'm having imposter syndrome right now. It apparently never goes away. I think that actually one of the things that's so true about running, about being even being involved in a startup, much less running a startup, is there is never, it feels like there's never time to just like rest. You know, you solve a problem and then you're like, okay, now we've got this new thing that we don't know how to do. All right, let's learn how to do that. So it's all what you all, I feel like I personally, and I think a lot of people on our team feel like we're always in a situation that we don't know how to solve. And that's just the nature of it. So imposter syndrome kind of all the time. I touched on this a little bit in the beginning about team building. So the founding team for us was defined by the people that were worked on the invention of the product and or the technology at UCLA. And that was basically the founding team of the company and an advisor that we had brought in that had some commercial experience. I think in the beginning, making sure that every person that's a founder in the company sits around the table and has a real conversation with each other about like, what's this going to look like for each person individually? And what does each person want? That's something that is a very important conversation to have, because you don't want to get in a situation where somebody's doing something they don't want to do or didn't feel like they signed up for or just wasn't really what they wanted to do, right? So like, for example, in our founding group, I was the only one that came out of academia, which it has worked out well for us, right? Because they have been able to continue to generate early R&D data based off of this technology and other areas that we potentially could utilize in the future and have been great advisors for us, but they're not coming in to be operators, right? And that's a totally different situation than being an advisor. So I think being very upfront with your co-founders about who's going to be an operator and who's going to be an advisor and understanding the difference in those roles. And also being real about, you need operators of the company. It can't just be one person. So then that kind of leads me to building a team in the company. I mentioned previously that you really want to have people that have experience in your specific vertical and area. Funny part about this is when we started Tempo, we didn't know if we were going to be a medical device or a drug. We didn't know. Sometimes when you're developing these brand new technologies that kind of don't really fit in a box, you have to go to the FDA and you have to have conversations with them about like, how are you going to regulate this? So that was a really interesting learning experience for us to understand, are we a drug? Are we a biologic? Are we a device? Like, and then you figure out, okay, well, now I'm a device. So I got to figure out how I, you know, build my team around that. I think bringing in people that have been in startups before is very important. I say that and I laugh, but it's because the road is extremely rocky and you have big ups and you have big downs and you have crunch times and you have layers of unknown that some people just can't handle. So I think really understanding that you need to bring in people who are up for the risk and can share in that with you is super important. We're complicated. People are weird. We're weirdos. We're complicated. We're just so annoyingly complicated. That's the biggest like risk factor, I think, honestly, in a company, because if you don't have the right group together, you can't execute.
So one of the things that we do in these podcasts is talk to people about how they've navigated change. And clearly you've had a couple of things change, because you came in as a scientist. And then you're made CEO, and then you got to start running a business, and then you got to start navigating the regulatory environment and on and on and on. How have you done that?
Well, I've been lucky enough to be able to surround myself with people that have done it before. I would say that is the emphatic statement that I'll make over and over and over again. So I had no idea what being a CEO was even about when I decided to do it, which is probably one of the reasons I said yes. you know, naivety is sometimes a good thing. So I would say that the job of a CEO is to have a very strong conviction about an idea of what you want to do and to sell that idea to everyone, whether it's a customer, whether it's an investor, whether it's a potential employee, whether it's a consultant, everyone. You're selling everyone on the vision of what you want to do. Now, you're not going to necessarily come up with every little piece of that. That's why you have to bring people in to help you think about regulatory, operations, manufacturing, quality, all of these things. But you, in the beginning, because you've got nothing to give anyone, you don't even have any money, right? You have to figure out, how do you convince these people to come and help you, you know? So in the early days, I was bringing on people as advisors and, you know, allowing them to vest, you know, options and equity. But again, you have to sell them on the vision in order for that to mean something to them, right? It's like, if they don't believe in what you're doing, they'll be like, I don't really care about these options. They're not going to, what is this worth, right? But if you can convince somebody that what you're doing is meaningful and they agree in that meaning, you can get a long way in the early days. And so what I have found is that people who've worked in drugs are not good candidates for team members to come in to work on medical devices. Very different industries.
Can you give me a short Cliff Notes version of why that's true?
It really comes down to the way that the FDA regulates them and the way that they are paid for in the marketplace. Those are the two things. So the FDA regulates medical devices very differently than they do drugs. Medicare, or we'll say private insurers, pay for medical devices in a very different way than they pay for drugs. That means that the entire development process and the commercialization dynamics of the products are completely different, and therefore the skill sets are different. And I have definitely made that mistake more than twice, where, you know, you find somebody who's got a great pedigree in drugs and you really like the way that person thinks and they're excited about what you're doing and everybody has the best intentions, right? And then they come in and you realize that, like, honestly, they're having to learn it just the way you're having to learn it, because it's so different than from drug development, that you're like, oh man, this actually isn't going to work out. And I need to go find somebody who has the experience in this specific industry and medical device. In general, the clinical requirements for devices are less than the clinical requirements for drugs and biologics, just because of the nature of how these things work, right? Devices are implants. They have a physical mode of action. They're kind of guided by, like, engineering principles for the most part. I mean, there's definitely a lot of overlap with biology, but a drug is something where, you know, you're infusing it into somebody's blood, or, you know, you're injecting them with something that could go anywhere within their body. And so the safety, It takes a lot longer to understand the appropriate safety and toxicologic risk profiles. You still have to demonstrate efficacy, right? The effectiveness of the product in both cases. But it's a little bit more burdensome, I think, to demonstrate safety in a drug or a biologic as compared to a device. And again, this also gets into why they're totally different businesses. Because if you think about from the business standpoint, let's talk about, like, the risk profile of a business to an early investor. You know, you're going to invest in this thing in a seed stage and you've got all this risk in front of you, all coming from all different angles. You've got technical risk, you've got regulatory risk, you've got market risk, you know, you get all these things. In a drug, you really are heavily focused on technical risk. Does your drug do what you think it's going to do? And can you demonstrate that in a clinical trial format? If you can, you have reduced a significant amount of the risk, because the way that our healthcare system works, and at least in the US, which is one of the major markets in the world, once you get that drug approved by the FDA, you name your price. And that's what the insurers pay for it. There's no negotiation process. That's not the case for medical devices. You do not name your price in medical device. You negotiate with the insurer or the payer for what your price is. That means that there's a whole other layer of risk for the business that doesn't necessarily exist in the drug business, right? You may have less regulatory risk or less clinical risk, but you've got a huge amount of commercialization risk. And ultimately, you know, the insurer is still looking for that level of clinical trial data to show, what are you doing for my covered patient? And also, how are you controlling my healthcare expenditure cost? So it's a whole different ball game that you got to play with your customer to get to a sale than it is in the drug business. And that's why those things are very different, very separate, and the risk profiles are different. And honestly, the investors are different. People that, you know, VCs that invest in drugs don't invest in medical devices for the most part, and other way around, because it requires a whole different set of operational expertise.
In your business, you've got risk, like you said, coming from all angles. So which has been the most unexpectedly difficult throughout your tenure as CEO?
For me personally, it's actually been the commercialization, because that's where I have the least experience, you know, fully admittedly, right? As a scientist who is a first-time CEO, in med tech commercialization, that is a hard knocks situation. That's where you learn that stuff by doing it. And if you've never done it before, by definition, you don't know. And every product is different and has to be very carefully thought about how you're going to sell that product, what your value proposition is to all the stakeholders in that sale. And you really have to work backwards from that to define what is your regulatory strategy and therefore what is your clinical strategy. And if you don't work backwards, it can be very challenging, because you can kind of work yourself into quarters sometimes. And I'll fully admit that we have done that. more than twice.
A lot of the CEOs that we talk to have been in business their entire career. They were promoted from CEO to CEO or SVP to CEO. And, you know, they've just had 20 years of business experience to just know all the pitfalls and everything about it. Here you come in as a biomedical research associate into a CEO role with no real business experience. What were the biggest learnings or the biggest challenges that you faced?
I'm gonna get real, and I'm gonna say would not recommend. honestly, being able to learn in an actual development scenario where you're working at a company in a senior leadership role that could either be technical or otherwise, but learning all of the mechanics of the business and the correct thought processes for how you want to, like what I just talked about, like how, if you want to, like, let's say you're at a company and you're working at a medical device company that's maybe they have, like, you know, let's just for purposes of similarity to what Tempo is doing, we're working at a medical device company that is focused on dermatology. Okay. And you want to develop a solution for something in dermatology. The first thing you focus on is, what is the problem that you're solving? Who's the surgeon or the doctor that's currently seeing those patients right now? How are they currently making money seeing and treating those patients? Is your treatment going to disrupt that? And if that is, and that can be a bad thing. If you're disrupting a physician's payment stream in a way that causes them to get less money, you have to flag that immediately as a significant challenge that you figure out how to overcome. And if it's not something that you can overcome, you have to, like, rethink or back away from that. And if you are not thinking about that aspect, you are setting yourself up for potential failure. And honestly, when I think about, like, well, what is it? What is our purpose? Like, why are we here? We're here to try and make somebody's life better, that patient. But there are a lot of things that we have to do in order to make that a reality, which means that you can't be making the surgeon's life worse. You can't be doing that. And that's not something that is taught in biomedical engineering classes or, you know, in science classes or engineering classes. And I feel like that's something that is learned by doing. And it has really changed the way that I think about product strategy, about company strategy. If I could do this again, I might actually have gone to, like, work at a company and just kind of see how things go and start to learn and then try and, like, kind of go off and do my own thing. Now, again, shoulda, coulda, woulda, you can't undo things. And also, like, we were presented with an opportunity where we thought we had a really transformative technology and is that either we were going to do something with it or it was going to get sat on the shelf. So we decided to do what we did, right? I'll say I've been lucky enough to be able to kind of fail upward or fail sideways and upward, never too far backwards. But honestly, I think a lot of that comes from trying to be as humble as possible and realize that I don't know the answers to things and, like, really honestly listen to people. And there have been lots of conversations with many VCs where I've told them what we're going to do and they're like, oh, that's not going to work. And then trying to understand why they're saying that as best you can, knowing that they have no obligation to tell you that. They can just hang up the phone and be like, I don't have time for this. I have to go look at 50 other deals today. You know, trying to learn from that as much as possible has really kind of led me to this new thought process of understanding, okay, let's focus on the patient and the problem that we're solving in the patient. And then the next immediate thing is understanding what's the surgeon or the physician that's treating that patient and how do we align both of those stakeholders to want to adopt our product. And if we can do that, then I think we really have something.
Part of your management style that comes through is you're not a command and control guy. You're definitely, let's figure this out together.
I try to be a good listener. I'll be honest, that also presents its own challenges, especially with, as a CEO, dealing with a board of directors and who are, you know, investors. Sometimes managing up by consensus doesn't work. And maybe sometimes isn't the right word. Most times. And I've learned that the hard way. That's something that's a big challenge for me fundamentally as a person. Still, you know, that's just like the way that I like to approach problems is I like to get around a table, think about the problem, hear everybody's input, and then work on a consensus that we all think is the right one and work towards that and continuously iterate on that as we learn new things. And that works super well with a operational team. It can be very challenging with a board of directors. You know, you really kind of have to have like a, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Come at me, bro. Tell me, you know, like, that's why we're doing it. And let's battle this thing out. And I do not thrive
Well, that's just a totally different way. You know, the business side is one thing. The science side is another. But the management style of, all right, sometimes you got to just say, this is what we're going to do. We're not looking back. And as somebody who's not wired that way, I can relate.
I think that's something that's really interesting about developing medical products, whether it's biotech or a medical device company. You go in with a story that is based off of assumptions that you've made at the time. And sometimes you can go talk to the FDA and it really changes a lot of stuff really fast. You can go talk to them with the best due diligence that you've done and present to them your plan. And they come back to you and they say, no, bro, it's going to be this way. And that's not a small change. It might be a change that it results in something that was, you know, maybe it was a program that you thought was going to take 2 years and $15 million, and now it's going to take 7 years and $100 million. Like, no joke, that's the difference. And that can happen overnight. And when that happens, messaging that, figuring out how to like pivot around or through or whatever can be very challenging with investors. And again, it's not like, I mean, it should be challenging. Like, they've put money in, they're looking to get money out. You got to figure out how to make that happen. So much can change so quickly in our industry because of regulatory bodies. Operationally, you know, it can make it very challenging. And I want to be very clear that not only is it our duty and obligation to make sure that every person that uses our product knows that it's safe and effective. Number one, like, imagine, could you imagine if you went into a CVS and you bought Tylenol and you couldn't trust that, you know, you could take that and it would be safe for you? Like, what craziness would that be? That would be insane. Like, it's terrifying to think about. The FDA, their purpose is to make sure that every time you go into a CVS and you buy Tylenol, you're good. That's a significant amount of value for every single person that lives in this country. I think it also builds a ton of value in the industry because they are gatekeepers. And if you have a very strong wall up to companies coming into a marketplace, inherently you create more value in the marketplace. So it's like, even if you forget, you know, like, even if you're just looking at it from a money standpoint, the existence of the FDA actually creates value for you. I think that the FDA is a huge value to every single person in our country, and actually, honestly, every single person in the world, because drugs that are developed here go across the world and devices. It's a value creator for the industry. So yeah, it's a blessing and a curse, but more of a blessing than a curse. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm willing to go through these very challenging scenarios where you get nasty grams from the FDA because you didn't expect them to say something and you just have to figure it out.
We always ask, is there anything you thought we would ask that we didn't or that we should have?
This actually came from my co-founder. His name's Don Griffin. He is a professor of biomedical engineering at University of Virginia now. I think he was giving a talk on like being like a scientific co-founder and advisor to companies and trying to like give some input and perspective there. It was like a panel of people and they asked the panel, hypothetical question, you just got $200,000 and you're going to go start a biotech company. What's the first thing that you do? And it's funny because he was telling me this on just like a phone call the other day. And I had the exact same thought in my mind as what he ended up telling me, which is the following. Number one, I take that $200,000, I go to Vegas, and I put it on black, and I do it three times in a row. And if I hit three times in a row, then I start a biotech company. And actually, what I told him, I was like, okay, I've got $200,000 and somebody wants me to start a biotech company. I put it in a high-yield savings account, and I run. And I think that the message there is like, it doesn't, the amount of money is irrelevant. It's whether or not you're willing to undertake the risk. And also the fact that $200,000 gets you absolutely nothing, you know, whatever. But I think it's all about like, it's not about the money. It's about whether or not you think you can withstand the risk. And again, that's all based off of, have you identified a real problem? Because if you've identified a real problem, all of the hardship is worth it because you can have that North Star of like, there's a real problem that somebody really, really wants you to solve for them. Let's go do that.
Excellent. Excellent answer.
Westbrook, this has been fascinating. Fascinating. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Rethink Change. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. And be sure to follow the show so you don't miss a single episode. If you're a disruptor looking to challenge the status quo and don't know where to start or what to do next, Pennebaker can help. Find out more at pennebaker.com.